Thursday, April 20th. This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Coming up today, we're going to be talking about the New Jersey wildfires that have burned thousands of acres in the Pinelands. We'll be talking with the Assistant Commissioner of Parks and Forests, John Cecil, in just a few moments.
And sort of an environment Earth Day theme today, yeah. Cherry, because later in the hour, we're going to take a look at electric vehicles. The Biden administration is trying to speed up the transition to EVs, but there are a lot of questions. Will Americans get on board? Can the companies produce enough of them to meet demand? And where will we charge all of these EVs we are supposedly going to be buying soon? If you have questions, you can call us 888-477-9499. You can email us at studio2, that's the number 2, at whyy.org, or you can tweet at WHYY. The hashtag is Studio 2. But before we get there, Cherry, let's round up some news.
Yeah, the big story. You and I were talking about this. Mm-hmm. There will finally be an independent public poll in the Philadelphia mayoral race. Mm-hmm. I want to just do like some fake, you know, clapping because we really need this. The poll will be out next Friday, the 28th. It's going to be conducted by the Committee of 70, Urban Affairs Coalition, Fair Vote, the Philadelphia Citizen, and the Chamber of Commerce for Greater Philadelphia. The poll will survey about 1,000 Philadelphians. This is an extremely wide-ranging competitive mayoral field, something we have not seen in recent mayor's races. And it'll be the only poll. And a lot of people are confused. We've heard that a lot of folks are undecided, and there are a lot of benefits to having an independent poll. Because you'll know where the race stands. You'll know if you've been backing a long shot, all sorts of things. People will know about their ground game before Election Day. Avi, reaction.
Well, let me put on my devil's advocate hat.
Okay, go right ahead.
Because you were clapping. And I'm not going to take a position on this, just devil's advocate. Okay. It will only be one poll.
Facts.
One poll can be extremely misleading because it is just one poll.
It's
just
only 1,000
people. Sample size of 1,000 people, and you have to try to weight it correctly, and it's hard to do. The other thing is that so much of the national electoral coverage, whether it's the president's race, the U.S. Senate race, has become basically poll coverage. It's just horse race coverage of polls and people not really talking about issues. And it has been sort of refreshing historically in local races that you almost have to talk about the issues because there are no polls to talk about. Now, there will at least be one very big poll to talk about in the mayor's race. And so I understand the advantages. It's sort of transparency. It's disclosure. I do think there are legitimate disadvantages as well.
But I will say this. We've had a lot of forums.
Yes.
We talked about a lot of issues.
Enough issues.
Everybody has interviewed everybody like a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And so we even had, you know, we were doing our interviews when we were talking off mic to the candidates.
Yeah.
Jeff Brown was here. He was like, I had like 35, 36 forums.
He said 35 forums. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you think about that and there's another forum tomorrow night. Mm-hmm. There was one yesterday. So there's been a lot of discussion. I mean, thanks to, you know, the Linfest Foundation and Every Voice, Every Vote funding a lot of this, but folks still don't know where anyone stands, and I think a lot of people are just more confused.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people are curious.
And curious.
Well, yes. Whoever is elected mayor, they will have a lot to say about what happens to the future of SEPTA.
Yes.
And SEPTA is planning its own future in a very interesting way. They announced yesterday that they are going to upgrade the key card system known as SEPTA Key. So if you've ever used SEPTA, you've probably used SEPTA Key. Mm-hmm. You have to at this point. SEPTA is sort of overhauling the system. They're trying to, I think the upshot of what they're trying to do is they're trying to create a system that's a little less closed and is easier to sort of update and keep up with the times instead of having like a system that has to be run everything through one vendor, right? It's easier to upgrade the system. It's easier to make it more flexible whenever the next payment trend comes on board. So anyways, they're looking for a new vendor. They're looking to upgrade this key card system, and it's going to change the way you and I interact with SEPTA at some point.
Yeah, and I think it's a good thing. I mean, SEPTA spent $236 million on this fare system, which is twice what they originally allocated for it. So they've invested a lot, and now they're going to move away from it. But it's like we're in the backwoods because you go to Chicago, you go to New York. You mm-hmm. don't need a card. You can use your phone.
Well, we grew up in the D.C. area,
yeah.
So we grew up taking Metro, right?
Very privileged down there.
I won't go into all the details, but years and years and years ago, way before... way before now, they had a system that was kind of like a card system. Mm-hmm. And when I moved up here and I realized you still had to put like a literal token.
Like token. You were like, in the machine.
I was like, where are we? What century are we in? And I'm not going to say like a payment system is not the most important thing about a public transit system, but it is the one thing that everyone interacts with. And I think people's perceptions of a transit system are very much influenced by how easy it is to use and how easy it is to pay and how like up to date the payment system is. So I feel like it is kind of important to get it right.
No, it's totally important. And our system was obsolete when they launched it, according to, you know, reporting. Yeah. I won't say I didn't say that, but according to reporting.
According to reporting, yeah.
But, you know, and when we had the SEPTA CEO on
Leslie Richards, yeah,
that was one of the questions, like, when are we going to be able to use our phones? Why do we need an extra card? Yeah. When are we going to move into the future? So guess what, y'all, the answer is
now.
They're looking. They're looking. So, and you know, speaking of SEPTA, you might want to take the Broad Street line if you're trying to get down South Broad Street for the next couple of hours. Why? Well, the Philadelphia Music Alliance, they're honoring musicians and music pros that have had an impact on the city today with a marker on the Walk of Fame along the Avenue of the Arts. That's pretty cool, right?
Very cool.
Yeah, so it's such a Philly thing. The inductees this year include Leslie Odom Jr. He's from East Oak Lane, and he kind of came to fame when he started the original production of Hamilton on Broadway. Others include Bacon Brothers, former governor and Philly mayor Ed Rendell, among others. And I got to give a shout out to Philadelphia's own Patty Jackson, renowned legendary broadcaster. She will become the first woman in radio to get the honor. Congratulations to everyone.
Yeah. And you said that Patty Jackson is someone who's been really helpful to other broadcasters
yes.
in the area.
And she bakes a mean peach cobbler. 41 years from South Philly.
She makes a good peach cobbler.
She does.
That's not why she's getting the star, but that's good intel.
41 years on radio. People like Quinta Brunson said she grew up listening to Patty Jackson on the radio. Jill Scott grew mm-hmm. up listening to Patty Jackson on the radio. So
shout out to Patty Jackson
to
and
Patty
everyone
Jackson.
Who's being honored
yeah,
today. I do like those stars, by the way. Sometimes
they're
when
so
I walk
cool.
down that street, I'll look down at my feet and just read a name and then like Wikipedia it, you know, because their stars are literally
yeah,
on the
and
street.
They, and yeah. they go and it's like history
yeah.
right on the ground as you walk down. And it's a nice piece of legacy.
Absolutely. So we want to shift now to our newsmaker interview. We're going to go across the river to New Jersey, where there have been several wildfires recently, some very serious ones, including in the past 2 weeks. We've seen flames reaching over 200 feet. We've seen structures threatened. Folks there, the firefighters there, are doing their best to contain the flames, prevent them from spreading any further across the state. But of course, this raises big questions yeah. about why we're seeing so many wildfires, what the cause is. Climate change is certainly in the mix there. And to tell us more is John Cecil. He is the Assistant Commissioner of State Parks, Forests, and Historic Sites at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Commissioner John Cecil, welcome to Studio 2.
Good afternoon.
And so let's jump right in. We're happy that you're here today because we want to talk about these recent wildfires. I mean, last year there were two major fires burning at the same time. We also had at least 30 structures threatened just yesterday. Can you give us an update on the top concerns right now in Burlington and other counties?
Sure. So here we are, 2023, and we've already had, since the beginning of the year, 535 major wildfires burn 7,896 acres. Compare that to 2022, where we had 331 wildfires and only 472 acres. So this year is definitely proving to be a little more dramatic and concerning. And just in the last 2 weeks, as you suggested, four major wildfires from the southern part of the state to the north.
How does that compare historically, John? Because obviously it's more than last year, as you mentioned. Is it among the most active years ever, or can you sort of try to position it some way for us?
For sure. So I would say one of the more active years in recent history, but
okay.
we're actually looking at the 60th anniversary over the next couple of days of Black Saturday, when in 1960 there were 37 major wildfires that burned 180,000 acres in New Jersey.
Wow.
Now, obviously, you know, you go back 60 years, the landscape was very different in the state, a lot more undeveloped land that would allow for such a dramatic situation, but nonetheless, we have had a lot of wildfires this year, and the threat remains high.
And so let's dig into some of the causes of these wildfires. I know human activity is part of it, but what are the major causes that can lead to this and such devastation?
Well, you're right in that the vast majority of wildfires are started by people. We estimate 99% of fires are started by people, whether that's by accident, you know, people not tending to a campfire appropriately, or maybe letting an agricultural burn gets out of control, car crashes, electric utility lines shorting out, those kinds of things. And then, you know, those that are deliberately started and ends up with folks being prosecuted and sent to jail. But nonetheless, what is in the background of all of this is the reality of climate change. We are living in an environment where the climate is changing. We're seeing warmer temperatures for longer periods of time. We're seeing extreme storms. So we went from a situation in 2019 where we had one of the wettest years, I believe it was the 17th wettest year in New Jersey's history, and the 10th warmest, to a drought situation last year. And so that variability in weather conditions certainly has an effect. We also have environmental conditions. We have invasive plants and insects. We've had the emerald ash borer kill ash trees in our forests. And that's one of the things that exacerbated the fire that we saw in West Milford just last week.
Hmm. One of the things that I'm trying to wrap my head around is the positive attributes, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, of fires in the forest. Because it does seem like on some level, certain ecologies depend on burns to regenerate and to keep out invasive species. So are there fires that are good for ecosystems? And if so, how do you promote those without, you know, bringing on devastation and damage?
Yeah, absolutely. A really great point. So you look at the pinelands of New Jersey. We have 1 million acres of pine forest that's dependent on fire. Those trees have what's called serotonous cones, which the cones are kind of sealed up if you were to pick one up off the forest floor, and only really open when they get hot from a fire and release those seeds, and that's what helps start a new forest. So fire is part of the ecosystem. The challenge that we're faced with now is that we have suppressed disturbance in the forest and for many, many years not allowed it to burn. So you have an accumulation of forest fuels, and then you get these devastating fires. Mm. We actually undertake prescribed burning in the early part of the year to mimic that naturally occurring fire that would have typically been there. That is good for the plants and animals because, it stimulates those seeds to grow, creates habitats for animals, and ultimately protects people. One of the fires that we had just this past weekend, the Log Swamp Fire, we ultimately were able to get that under control because of a prescribed burn that we did just this past March. So prescribed burns are critically important for the environment and also for our safety.
And we only have we have less than a minute, but I want you to give advice to our listeners on what they should do to avoid, you know, being part of the problem here.
Yes. So people should be very safe with their use of fire, whether that's, you know, their campfire or the ashes that they're disposing of from their fireplace. And they should stay tuned to NewJerseyWildfire.org, NJWildfire.org, to check the status of fire danger throughout the state. Right now we have stage one campfire restrictions in central New Jersey, very high danger in central New Jersey, and in the north and south we're just at a high danger level. So stay attuned to those stages of restrictions and be very careful with the fires that you're having in your homes and in your campsites.
We will certainly stay attuned. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Thank you.
John Cecil is the Assistant Commissioner of State Parks, Forests, and Historic Sites for the New Jersey DEP.
Coming up, we're talking about electric vehicles. We hope to hear from you.
Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you are listening to Studio 2 on 90.9. I drink a lot of coffee. My name is Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, do you drive an electric car? Or are you thinking about getting one?
I drive a hybrid. I would I would consider getting one, but it's a little tough because I live on a tiny street in South Philly with no parking, so I don't know how I would charge it.
Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, I'm considering it, especially after last week. That is when President Joe Biden announced a new plan to push more Americans into EVs a lot faster. The White House has proposed higher vehicle emission standards, which would mean that 2/3 of all new cars would have to be electric by 2032. Right now, only 6% are.
That's a transformation.
That is.
Of course, that could be great news for the environment. We all know that transportation contributes to greenhouse gases in major ways. But there are lots of hurdles to overcome. Mm-hmm. First, you have to mine all the rare materials that are used in the batteries. You have to build all the charging infrastructure. We just alluded to that. And there are many, many more questions. Mm-hmm. So here to help answer them is Professor John Paul McDuffie, who directs the Wharton School's Program on Vehicle and Mobility Innovation. John Paul McDuffie, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you here. So we welcome your questions and comments. Are you an EV driver? What's been your experience owning an electric car? How do you handle long road trips? Let us know. Email studio2@whyy.org. You can tweet at WHYY and use the hashtag studio2, like the number, or you can call us at 888-477-9499.
So, John Paul, I wanted to start here, zooming out. What do we know about how much normal cars, non-electric cars, contribute to greenhouse gas emissions? Like, what chunk of the pie is it?
Yeah, that's a great starting point. Transportation in the U.S. is now the largest source of greenhouse gases. It's about 27% of total U.S. emissions. And cars and light duty, you know, SUVs and trucks are about 57% of that. And then the heavier, bigger trucks are about 26%. It used to be the generation of electricity that was the greatest source of emissions. But there's been such rapid progress in using alternative sources like wind and solar that now it's transportation. So really, electrifying transportation is the fastest route to reduce greenhouse gases in the U.S.
And so I want to dig into the numbers a bit, because we said right now only about 6% of all new cars are electric. Let's talk about the new Biden proposal, rule 2 out of 3 new cars. They want that to be electric. How significant is this for automakers? And is it actually feasible to have that the outcome by 2032?
I think everyone would agree that it's ambitious, maybe even super ambitious. You'll get different viewpoints on how attainable it is. But it's certainly a steep curve. I think one thing to be said is that 6% is a small number. And if you look around the world, it's a pretty low level. But it's grown really surprisingly rapidly in the U.S. I think most people who follow this are surprised at how much the sales have increased in the last few years. And Bloomberg did a careful look at every country and its sort of pattern of increasing EV sales. And usually after you pass 5%, there's a real kind of uptick in how steep the climb is after that. So it really felt significant to pass 5% in 2022.
So what do you see as maybe the single biggest hurdle to meeting the Biden administration's goal? Is it supply chain? Is it battery production? Is it charging infrastructure? Or maybe it's none of the above. What do you signal out as the one thing they've got to get right to meet this target?
You're making it hard on me saying one.
You could do two if you want.
I could do two. I think I would have to do two, because you've got charging infrastructure availability and supply chain sort of neck and neck, I think, here. One is going to affect the supply of the vehicles, and the other is going to affect the demand. So maybe that's another way to talk through it. I perhaps as a start, Avi, I heard you say that you live in South Philly.
Yep.
And can't imagine having an electric vehicle. I live closer to Rittenhouse Square, Fittler Square, and I park on the street, and I can't figure out how I would have a pure electric vehicle either. I'm debating whether to go with a plug-in hybrid. So you have to start with the fact that people have really dramatically different charging situations. But for people who live in rural and suburban areas and can install the equivalent of what they'd put in to support a dryer, you know, a 240-volt line, they can charge these vehicles overnight and get all that they need. The range is now, you know, well over 300 miles on a charge for most of these vehicles, and most people's average commute is about 40 miles a day. So for people in that situation, this whole issue of building out charging infrastructure isn't a big deal until they take a road trip. So, but everyone takes road trips. So we've got to have the federal interstate highway system well supplied with fast chargers, superchargers. And then we've got to find a way to get to the folks who live in urban areas, live in apartment buildings. We've got to get charging into workplace parking lots, into parking lots for while you're out and about doing errands.
Yeah.
So that's one big thing. Then, as you pointed out, we need these minerals for the batteries. And that's such a rapidly changing area that I might save it for another question. Okay. So I could dig into a little bit.
Yeah, and we do have a couple questions, but I want to bring in a caller because I just checked. I filled up my tank the other day, just earlier this week, $3.85 a gallon in Philly. I want to bring in someone who talks about the savings here. Bruce is calling from Westchester. And Bruce, what's your comment?
I'm a handyman, and my old Nissan van, which has all sorts of tools and lots of weight in it, I used to spend anywhere from like $100 to $150 a week on fuel cost. Last June, I bought a Ford E-Transit. That's a fully electric Ford work van. It's the midsize van. Its range is pretty limited. It's only about 130 miles in range. But for what I do in my work, I can charge every night, but what I end up doing is charging about once a week. And so my fuel cost went from, you know, 100 to 125 a week to about $5 or $7 a week for electric charging at my home.
Wow, that's dramatic.
And one other comment I would make is I used to work in the Public Ledger building just down from you, and they have pictures of electric trucks that you used to take the Saturday Evening Post in the 1920s up to 30th Street to be delivered by the U.S. Mail across the country. So what is old is new again. The electric truck, you know, is back in the 20s, too.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
John Paul, I wonder, building off of that, could you talk about public messaging? Because Bruce just made a very compelling pitch for going electric, but I'm sure a lot of people have to be convinced. What does the path forward look like there? Who needs to be convinced, and how can they be convinced?
I need to be convinced.
I mean, I think just about everybody, perhaps, at some level, needs some convincing because it's so new and there's so many different aspects of it. People naturally look at the purchase price of the vehicles, and electric vehicles are definitely more expensive. There's a whole thing happening with tax credits from the Biden administration that we can get into, but Bruce is absolutely right. The recharging cost is going to be dramatically lower. Maybe not as much for somebody who has a sedan as who has a van, and the operational costs are a lot lower too in terms of maintenance. No oil changes, you know, no transmission fluid top ups, and so over the lifetime of a vehicle, there's an estimate of at least what I've seen recently, you know, about $1,200 in savings simply on operational costs. That's separate from the fuel costs. How can we get people to focus not just on the purchase price, but also on the total life of ownership costs? I think that's really important. The tax credits will help get over the hurdle of the high purchase price.
Yep, yeah, absolutely.
And we are speaking with John Paul McDuffie, Director of the Program on Vehicle and Mobility Innovation at Wharton. Give us a call. Tell us your thoughts. Do you have an electric vehicle? Are you in the market for one? What would convince you to get one? You can call 888-477-9499 or email us at studio2@whyy.org. Our listener, Elaine, asked, do electric cars use lithium batteries? We've been hearing a lot about them catching on fire. See, this is one of the things that you know, would keep people from wanting to take that leap and go ahead and go EV?
Yes. Battery electric vehicles, which is what we're talking about, all use lithium batteries at present, and that looks like it's going to be the dominant technology for a while. I think the most exciting development in this area is there's a lot of experimentation with battery chemistries. And I think the key thing to say here is that one of the newest and most promising uses lithium, but it also uses just iron and phosphate, which are very commonly available and very safe. This particular chemistry is not susceptible to fire like some earlier chemistries have been. Some earlier chemistries also use minerals like cobalt and nickel, which are in short supply. And with cobalt, there's concern about, you know, human rights violations and things connected with its mining. I think just a few months ago, and certainly going back for some time, a lot of people would have said that the cobalt, for example, dependency of electric vehicles really worried them because of both the shortages and the mining conditions. And the fact that already we have a new and perhaps dominant battery chemistry coming along that doesn't use any cobalt or nickel at all is just a sign of how much innovation is happening in this area. We may innovate our way around some of the worst of these supply chain dilemmas.
Yeah, things are changing so fast. I wonder also about charging time, because people certainly are used to the convenience of filling up that gas tank and it taking, you know, a couple minutes at most. And of course, then I see people at the gas station using one of those publicly available charging stations, sitting there looking like they're marooned in this terrible, foul-smelling gas station. But I mean, that seems like a sort of prosaic concern. But I am genuinely curious. Like, is that going to change? Are charging times going to speed up?
You know, the supercharging technology is certainly available. We know how to do it. It's a little more complicated to install in terms of the grid requirements. I think it just means part of what we're going to have to watch is not just statistics on the total number of chargers installed, but what type of chargers there are. You know, there's a bunch of older chargers out there that are both slow and not very reliable. Mm-hmm. So it's very disheartening and for a new EV owner to, you know, find their way to one of these chargers and have it completely not work. And then there's the issues of how long the charging time takes. So I think it's why the federal government role in, again, spurring investment and domestic manufacturing of superchargers, getting them installed in the peak places where people take long road trips, but, you know, also businesses putting in chargers and opting for faster chargers, workplaces doing the same. We've got to see movement on the charging front that's fast enough to keep this momentum, perhaps, in the public perception that this change is really going
to
happen.
And that's what I wanted to talk to you about a little bit, too, because the issues of EVs and clean, you know, vehicles is political in a lot of ways, right? And it depends on who's in power. Could there be political and even legal hiccups that sort of slows this down to where, you know, the gas guzzled folks are like, you know what, there's no need for me to go EV because this isn't going to happen anyway.
The new rules.
Yeah. The new rules, right.
Well, the new rules are just that. They're proposed rules. They go through a public comment period, and they could be revised before they're released. There's also already a bunch of lawsuits coming up in exactly the political way that you mentioned, which could make a difference. We already know there's often some negotiation before these rules are implemented and targets are lowered. But I have to say that the auto industry, which obviously is heavily affected by this, really wants stability in the rules and requirements. And I think it's really pretty fair to say that they're on board for the necessity and the inevitability of this transition. It's just a question about pace. They think the Biden rules are a little too fast, but they want stable rules. And so what we saw between the Obama administration, the Trump administration, the Biden administration, which was a huge pendulum swing from aggressive goals for emissions reduction under Obama, almost trying to reverse them completely under Trump, and now Biden with a new and even more ambitious set of goals that matches the moment and the technology. It would really be, I think, kind of devastating to the momentum we've seen recently if we had more of those pendulum swings. You could get back into a chicken and egg problem where, you know, things get stalled enough that nobody wants to make that purchase decision.
Yeah, the zigzag can be so destructive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Want to bring in another caller, but if you're just joining us here on Studio 2, we are talking with John Paul McDuffie, who is a Wharton professor who knows everything there is to know about EV industry in this country. Hmm. Going to go to the phones here. I'm sorry, am I gassing you up too much there, John Paul?
Yeah, maybe. It's hard to keep up. I'll do my best.
So we're going to bring in Jay from Gladwin. Jay, you're on Studio 2. What is your comment?
Well, we're on our fourth electric vehicle, and we had plug-in hybrids before that, and one thing I think is often overlooked is the time savings, because we don't have to go to a gas station, you know, every week and spend 10 or 15 minutes there. We don't have to take it in for oil changes or tune-ups, almost zero maintenance except rotating the tires.
Wow.
So in addition to saving money, I think it saves me personally a lot of time, and that's a really important aspect of ownership for us.
That's got to be part of the messaging, right, John Paul? It's not just about saving money. It's about saving time if you make this switch.
Yeah, Jay is convincing folks out here. Yeah. I love it.
I mean, you know, there's so many ways besides the kind of urgency of the climate change challenge to talk up the advantages of electric vehicles. The time and ownership cost savings, that was very well put by this caller. You know, there's just the fun to drive aspect, the acceleration with electric vehicles, you know, obviously more as you get to the larger or the luxury versions, but is kind of exhilarating. There's no torque steer. It holds the road. You know, and we're going to see companies marketing, you know, muscle car EVs before long. That seems to be where Chrysler's going with this whole thing. So, you know, I think GM has a new logo, Everyone In, and I think a lot of people feel like we're going to have to talk this up in a way that is inviting to everybody, because making the transition is that important, and because there's enough arguments to make that you probably can find something for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I got to ask you this. I mean, I'm literally making this decision. The question is, do you do it now or do you wait 2 years when it's like cheaper? You know how you buy the newer product and then you're kicking yourself because prices they go down dramatically. Any ideas on that?
Well, I mean, it's, the one thing I'll say, because it gets to this tax credit thing, the way that the Biden administration has written these rules, they're trying to advance the goals of having the manufacturing of electric vehicles and batteries be in the U.S. and also bring more of the supply chain either to the U.S. or to countries that we have free trade agreements with. And that means that there's some restrictions on how many vehicles get the tax credit and to give time for these adjustments. But, I mean, if you watch the papers, almost every week there's announcements of new investments in battery plants in the U.S., sometimes new mining going on in the U.S. or some of these free trade countries. And that's going to steadily increase the number of models that you would have available to buy and get that full $7,500 tax credit.
Yeah,
so I guess cautiously, I'd say if you wait a few years, you're going to have more choices.
Interesting. Well, there's so much more to get to. We didn't even get to the state stuff, which I really wanted to talk about, but we'll have John Paul back another time. John Paul, thanks for joining us on Studio 2. Coming up, we've got Studio 2 Trivia. Stay with us. Right now on WHYY, you're listening to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, are you ready?
Oh, I'm always ready.
All right. Stay ready. You don't have to get ready. It is time for our weekly Studio 2 Trivia Challenge. If you want to play in the future, you can give us a call and leave a message at 215-351-0525. And this week, we have Shirley from Wynwood on the line. Shirley, how you doing?
Hi, I'm great. Thank you.
So what's your guilty pleasure TV?
Oh, goodness. I'm stumped because I don't really watch TV.
Oh, no.
Oh, it's all right. Well, maybe this could be that she's a, you know, we don't know. But I'm rooting for
it's
you
here.
It's
not a TV-based question.
It's not a TV question.
You don't have to worry.
Yeah, you could be a total shoe-in here.
Good.
Total shoe-in.
So, Shirley, we got big stakes on the line. If you don't know already,
yes.
If you get this question right, you get a WHYY grocery tote bag.
Oh.
You can tote stuff around with WHYY on the outside. Shirley, are you ready?
Yes, ready.
Our area has a lot of historic theaters, but only one can credibly claim to be the oldest operating theater in the United States. Is it the Academy of Music, the Queen, the Forest Theater, or the Walnut Street Theater? What are you thinking? Give me a sense of what you're thinking
here.
Walk us
through it.
I mean, I know the Academy of Music is legendary, mm-hmm. but I honestly don't know. That would be my guess, but I'm thinking I'm not right.
Is it the final guess?
I think so, yeah.
Oh! Oh, I'm so sorry, Shirley. And I was really rooting for Shirley because the backstory is that Shirley and I are like Twitter friends. And, yeah, so I root for everybody, but I was really rooting for Shirley. Unfortunately, the Academy of Music, you're not way off, Shirley. The Academy of Music is very, very old. It's just not as old as the Walnut Street Theater.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. It opened in 1809. That's super old.
Yes, that's how old the Walnut Street Theater is.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, there's a little tidbit for you. First theatrical performance at the Walnut Street Theater was called The Rivals. It's a play called The Rivals. Thomas Jefferson was in attendance at that play.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
That's how old the Walnut Street Theater is. But Shirley, we so do appreciate you putting yourself out there and coming on Studio 2 and doing a little Studio 2 trivia with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Shirley. And if you want to play in the future and do some Studio 2 trivia, you can give us a call again and leave a message. That number is 215-351-0525.
So if you want to go to the theater this weekend,
yes,
or you want to make some plans for this weekend, Sherry, mm-hmm. perhaps you should stay tuned to our next segment, which is
Yay.
Our Things to Do segment with Tanya Pendleton. I don't have any theater plans this weekend, but it doesn't mean other folks cannot enjoy the arts. If you want to know what's playing and what's shaking, Tanya's got you covered.
It's the Earth Day edition of Things to Do as we're celebrating this big planet we all share on Saturday. This is a day to get outside, commune with nature, and do your part to make the Earth a better place.
Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
You can also check out WHYY's new page at WHYY.org News Climate Desk, where we'll keep you updated on all things climate. You'll want to check that out since lately it's gotten hard to tell which season we're even in. But since the calendar says spring, we'll go with that and hope the weather is good for some fun outdoor events on Earth Day. Egg Harbor Township is the place for the biggest Earth Day Festival in South Jersey, and Delaware State Parks have several events planned, including guided nature hikes. There's a green tree planting in West Philly, and in the Northwest, the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education is the location for Naturepalooza. It's an all-day event with food trucks and live music, along with hikes, arts and crafts, and activity tables for all. And it's free with registration. You can find all the details on our website, whyy.org/things to do. Being in nature is one way to enjoy the outdoors, but for others, being outside is only fun when there's a festival. On Sunday, there are two. In South Philly on 7th and Catherine, the Everyday Futures Fest Block Party brings science, art, food, and entertainment together. More than 50 cultural organizations joined up for this fest, which also features several art installations. It's free, and it gets started at noon. In Manayunk, the annual Street Festival, emphasis on eat, starts at 11 a.m. I'd suggest skipping breakfast beforehand, as most of Philly's favorite food trucks will be there. April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and on Saturday, the 9th annual Center City Jazz Festival features 20 bands performing at 5 different venues over 6 hours, all within walking distance of each other. The festival returns after a 3-year hiatus, and an all-access pass is just $20. Let's appreciate that. Things get started at 1 p.m. The month continues with the Neighborhood Jazz Series. Beloved local musician Jamaluddin Takuma and the Brotherhood Collective will commemorate Eid al-Fitr, the end of Ramadan for the Muslim community, with a live performance. It's at the Masjid Allah for Human Excellence on Friday night, starting at 5. Robert Nesta Marley left the world in the physical form in 1981, but his message of love, peace, and unity still resonates. To celebrate Earth Day, Brooklyn Bowl Philadelphia hosts the music of Bob Marley for kids with Ja People. Let's teach the babies, y'all. Things get started at noon.
I am I, Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha. My destiny calls and I go.
The Man of La Mancha may have been fictional, but he was also on a quest to improve the world. You can see how that went at the Delaware Theater Company's adaptation of the classic musical. It's playing through April 30th.
Always thought the game came easy. You never thought about it twice. You never thought about it twice.
Natalie Merchant is a little older and grayer now than when she was the front woman for 10,000 Maniacs, but her gorgeous voice is unchanged by time. If you want to hear her in person, she'll be at the Miller Theater on Friday at 7:30. The show is officially sold out, but tickets are still available through resellers. You can also try going directly to the box office, as ticket availability can change. Leaving you with Natalie and Abena Coombson's Big Girls to ease you into the weekend. I'm Tanya Pendleton, and we'll be back this time next week with more things to do. For details on what you've just heard and even more, we invite you to our website, whyy.org/things to do. Whatever you choose to do, have a great weekend, everyone.
I have to say, I'm a little upset that I'm going to miss the Center City Jazz Fest this weekend. I have gone to that festival for so many years.
Why aren't you going this year?
Yeah, I'm going to be busy and out of town.
Aww.
But Ernest Stewart, shout out to him because he's done a great job at that festival. I'm glad they're back.
Shout out Ernie Stewart. Ernest Stewart.
Ernest Stewart.
Ernest Stewart.
Yes.
Great job with the festival, Ernest Stewart. I can't make it either, so we'll both have to miss it.
We'll have to miss it. Well, that is it for Studio 2. Thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and welcome to Andreas Copes, our newest producer. Yay! Also, WHYY's audio general manager is Joan Isabella. Our engineer is Diana Martinez.
By the way, I just want to point out, even if you don't listen to this show as a podcast, it would really help if you go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review and subscribe. We would greatly appreciate it. For more on our show, you can also head to whyy.org/studio2. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great, great, great weekend.